You're listening to WGN Radio. I'm your host, Patty Vasquez, and I am thrilled to welcome in studio Patrick Radden Keefe, who has written Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. And Patrick, I know it's already been kind of a long day. How long have you been touring so far, giving interviews on this new book?
Just about a week.
Just about a week?
A little over a week ago, yeah.
And so when you write the book, obviously you've written so many other pieces, whether it's for The New Yorker or, the work that you've, and you've been doing so much research and compiling this. This isn't really the goal, is to like go to every single interview possible, but it's so important, part of the process in a weird way too, isn't it?
It is, yeah, especially because this is a book about the troubles in Northern Ireland, which is not necessarily front of mind for people today. So part of it for me is just going out there and banging the drum and saying, I grew up in Boston, I was Irish American, I didn't really know all that much about what had gone on during the troubles, and I was just amazed when I got into it by the stories of these people. So it's going out and trying to persuade people that they should
pay attention.
Yeah, they should pay attention.
Well, it's funny, and we'll get to a question that my husband made me write out a little bit later.
Yeah.
Because, in a strange way, for me it was background noise too. I mean, there, obviously so many Americans are like, oh, my great grandmother Maggie O'Doyle,
okay,
is from,
yeah,
from Ireland, was from Ireland, and my father didn't really have that many stories about her, but the Irish are so, eager to tell their story,
yeah,
in so many different ways, right? But this one, we don't really understand. This isn't one that necessarily is something that's, as you mentioned, accessible to us. So I think that's probably a decent place to start, because I watch Dairy Girls, which,
uh-huh,
I know is so, it's a
great,
goofy show.
Yeah.
But, there was a line in one of the later episodes where they have this girl that's supposed to be from the nuclear fallout,
uh-huh,
right, from Russia. And she's like, why are you all fighting? You're all just different shades of the same, it's,
yeah,
the same religion. People really don't necessarily understand what was going on in Northern Ireland between the Unionists, the Protestants, the Catholics, what it meant.
Sure.
You want to tell us a little bit about what that strife was like leading into the 60s all the way to 1998?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there had been, you can go back almost 1,000 years.
Sure.
And people were leaving England to, cross that thin channel and go to Ireland and try and take over parts of it. And at various times during history, England had total dominion over Ireland. You ended up getting the Irish War for Independence, which happened in the 1920s. And after that, the island of Ireland was partitioned, so that in the south, you had the big part of the island, which is the Republic of Ireland. It's an independent country. But in the north, you had these six counties, which remained part of the United Kingdom. And in those counties, it was majority Protestant, whereas in Ireland of the South, it was majority Catholic.
Okay.
And the minority, the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland, was really pretty oppressed. They didn't have great civil rights, didn't have a lot of job opportunities, didn't have a lot of housing opportunities. There was a great deal of discrimination. So a lot of what they did was they just left. And this is the part of the reason you get so many Irish Americans, right, is that people left. They left in the 19th century. They left in the 20th century. There's 30 million people in America who claim Irish heritage, which is way more people than live in Ireland today. And that's kind of a testament to the fact that all these people left. And in the late 1960s, you had a period of time when, revolution is happening all over the world, and the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, which had been around for a long time, kind of evolved into a much more aggressive organization. And the idea was, we are going to stick it to the British and try and get them out. And as that happens, you also get terrorist groups that are Unionist or Loyalist terrorist groups, which are Protestant, loyal to the crown. You get the police, you get the British Army comes in. And so it was this kind of multi-vector conflict for decades that was just grinding along, this kind of long-running war right in Europe, in which 3,600 people were killed.
And, you also talk, there's such great storytelling in this, and obviously it's part biography, part politics, part history. But, the personal stories are, of course, Jean McConnell,
yeah,
who was abducted and murdered, and the discovery of her body in 2003, this incredible mystery. How many people were abducted and mysteriously buried? Was it about 18 people that,
yeah,
you talk
it was
about
just,
in the book?
Yeah, just a little over a dozen. So,
right.
I mean, this is the funny thing, right? There's this tactic, which is forced disappearances, which is when you don't just kill somebody, but you bury them in a secret grave and nobody knows what happened to them. In Latin America, this happened in huge numbers, thousands and thousands of people. But Northern Ireland is tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only ever, about 16, 18 people. And one of them was this woman, Jean McConville. And so what I did with the book was I didn't want to write a history of the Troubles.
Right.
I wanted to write this almost more like you would write a novel, where you tell a story about, they're real people, but, you know, about half a dozen characters. And one of them is this woman, Jean McConville, who was a 38-year-old mother of 10 in 1972. She was a widow. And one night, a gang of people came into her house and took her out. Her kids were screaming. They were clinging to her legs. And they never saw her again. And that's where the book starts. And it tells the story of her family and the victims of that act, but also the perpetrators, also the people who did that.
Well, and you talk about the Price sisters who, you know, they grew up like learning how to make these makeshift bombs, you know, and to even imagine that that's what your dad would be, just that's how you'd spend time together.
It's
so bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing for me looking at kind of political radicalism. And there had been this long tradition in Ireland, Northern Ireland, of you know, Irish Republicans, people who thought it's our duty to get rid of the British by any means necessary. And so these two sisters, Dolores and Marion Price, who are some of the big characters in the book, yeah, when they were little girls, their dad, who had himself been in the IRA, would, you know, put them on his knee and tell them stories about friends of his who'd been hanged by the British and how he went off himself to bomb the British, and he would tell them the recipe for mixing an IED.
Wow. And that's the thing. And for the way they grew up, you know, and you think about the sort of trajectory of, you know, the things that you do when you're young and now dealing with it. It's, you know, you kind of, as you mentioned, growing up in Boston, knowing something about the Troubles in Ireland, for many of us, we don't really pay that much attention. I was startled when I read that that Jean McConville was born in 1934, because my father would have just been 1 year older than her.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, this is all so recent, so intensely, you know, fresh.
Yeah.
And she had 14 children.
Yeah.
Jean had lost four.
Right.
And so the 10 children were, what were their age range? Like, some of them didn't even have an opportunity to have very many memories of her.
Right. So the oldest child was 20, and the youngest were two twins who were 6 years old. So they didn't, you know, this is one of the weird things about this story. So in adulthood, the younger kids, some of them couldn't even remember what their mother had looked like. There's one photo of her that survives, and of course they know that photo and what she looks like there. But apart from that photo, some of them couldn't really remember her face. But because Belfast is so tiny, one really strange feature of this story is that they do remember the faces of the people who took her away.
Oh, no.
And they see those people around the city, because those people have grown up too and had families of their own. There's a story in the book about Michael McConville, who is one of Jean McConville's children, as an adult, hailing a taxi one night and getting into the back seat of this black taxi, and the taxi pulls away from the curb, and Michael looks in the mirror and he realizes the guy driving the taxi is one of the people who took his mother away.
It's so chilling, and there's so much mystery in this, and you along the way, you know, are pulling this apart, unraveling it. How much, when you talk to people like Michael, I mean, what was it like for them to have these conversations with you? I know you didn't talk to all the kids.
Yeah, it was hard.
Yeah,
it was hard.
I mean,
look, I mean, these people are incredibly traumatized even now, and a lot of them have struggled. You know, they struggled as children. They were all orphaned and sent off to different orphanages, and a lot of them have struggled as adults. And I think these stories are pretty raw. And so, look, those weren't easy conversations at all. And it's hard, right? Because on the one hand, I feel great sympathy with them. On the other hand, I'm out here kind of trying to tell the true story as I can find it. And I think there's a virtue in that, right? So this was sort of the way it was with everyone. The book's called Say Nothing, right?
Right.
A lot of this stuff people don't want to remember. They don't want to talk about it. But I think that I think there's a service in going out there and trying to figure out what happened and explore that.
Well, and as you mentioned, living in the community together, you know, and with what might be coming down the road, we don't know what's going to happen next. And that's part of what I want to talk to you about more. Before we get to that, though, how did you start with emails? Did you start with phone calls? I mean, writing letters? What was the best approach to, I mean, every single person is going to respond differently.
Yeah. I mean, I interviewed more than 100 people for the book.
Yeah.
So over the course of 4 years, and I made 7 trips to Northern Ireland. So I approached different people in different ways. I mean, there were a lot of the time, it helped to find intermediaries. You know, sometimes I wouldn't go right to somebody. I'd go to somebody else that they trusted and just make the case for why I thought they should talk to me. And I'm an outsider, which I in some ways was a disadvantage, but it's in some ways was an advantage because, you know, when you go to a place like Belfast, when people there, the minute they open their mouths, everyone around them immediately forms judgments about who they are. You know, you hear the accent and you're like, okay, I know roughly where you are. I know what religion you are. I can probably take a guess at your politics. And so for me, the advantage was coming with, you know, I have an Irish name, but an American accent. They kind of couldn't plot me on the grid, you know, and there were some instances in which that hurt me, but a great many in which I think it actually helped. It made people more willing to tell me their story because they figured I didn't walk in with an agenda.
A neutral sort of perspective. We are talking to Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. He's making the rounds all over the country talking about this book and something exciting that just happened over the last couple of days that we'll talk about when we come back. I also want to talk about Brexit and what that might mean for Ireland. This is the long question that my husband, he was like, excellent. Okay, this is what I want you to ask him. So we'll talk about that when we come back on the Patty Baska Show, 720 WGN.
Clear is the water that flows from the Boyne, but my love is fairer than
You're listening to the Patty Baska Show. We are live. Well, we're not live. I'm going to be honest, Patrick. I don't like to lie to people and tell them that we pre-recorded this because you are so busy. We're talking to Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland, with part of the focus on Jean McConville, who was abducted and later found in a grave in 2003. She was abducted in 1972 and discovered, oh my God, it's just the life these children and her 10 children had to have endured, not knowing what happened to their mom. And as you mentioned in our last segment, some of them only remember the abductors. They were in an apartment building in these flats, and people heard some of the disturbance, but was it because, you know, it's just a loud building and she had a lot of kids that nobody really even thought to come out and check?
It was worse than that. I mean, this was a it was interesting. So they were a mixed family. Jean McConville was a Protestant woman who was married to a Catholic man, and they had lived in East Belfast. And which was more Protestant, and they were at the beginning of the Troubles. They were driven out of their home in East Belfast because they were too Catholic to be in that part of town. So then they end up in West Belfast in a very Catholic area, and there they're kind of too Protestant. They were sort of outsiders, and the building where they were was a huge housing project called Divis Flats, and the IRA was dug in there.
Okay.
And so what happened was that when she was taken away, nobody intervened to stop this from happening. And in fact, after she left, her children, it's heartbreaking, they wanted to stay in the apartment because they were convinced she was going to come back. And so they thought, we have to be here when she gets back. And you would think that the neighbors or others or the church would have realized you have this apartment full of kids taking care of themselves and stepped in to help. But nobody did. And I think it's for complicated reasons. It was a crazy, violent time. It was just a frightening time in Belfast. But also, there was a sense that the IRA had done this. The IRA had taken Jean McConville away, and nobody wanted to cross the IRA. So the kids end up getting split up and sent off to orphanages. And these were pretty horrendous institutions where more awful things happened to some of these children. So it was difficult, and they grew up with this kind of in a sort of a purgatory of uncertainty, not knowing what happened to their mother, not having a body to bury. And then finally, in 2003, there's a guy walking along a beach in the Republic of Ireland, and he sees some bones sticking out of the sand. And the authorities came, and they found a skull with a single bullet hole in it, and that was Jean McConville.
And she had the nappy pin still attached to her.
Yeah. The story is that, and I mentioned that the children, some of them don't remember what she looked like. What they do remember is that one thing she always wore was a safety pin, a blue safety pin. They call it a nappy pin because nappy is the word for diapers there.
Right.
And you can imagine if you're the mother of 10 kids, you know, it's useful to everybody's, people are losing a button. And you've got other reasons why you would.
I know. When I read that, I was like, how smart.
Exactly.
I never thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the sort of thing you can relate to. And that was something that I always remembered about her. And she disappears in 1972. And in 2003, this body is discovered. And they thought it might be Jean McConville. And they actually sent, they took a DNA sample. But before they got the results from that, they had some of her children come to a police station. And when they found the bones, there were clothes with them. There was some clothing. And they asked one of her sons, Archie, to come in and see if he could identify the clothes. And so he came in. And this is a grown man.
Right.
And he was 16 when his mother was taken away. And he found that he couldn't look at them. He couldn't bring himself to look at the clothes. He said, I don't want to see them. But he said, tell me something, though. Is there a nappy pin in the clothes? Mm-hmm. And the police officer said, yeah, there is. And that was when they knew it was their mother.
This is something that is, as you mentioned before, an important story to tell. And I have to wonder, how did you come across the story of Jean McConville, this family, this abduction and murder?
So I actually came upon it in 2013. And I should say, this is a famous case in Northern Ireland.
In Ireland,
I mean,
right.
Yeah, there are many, many victims of the Troubles, but Jean McConville is one of the most famous of them because it's such an extreme case. I had never heard of it. And in my day job at The New Yorker, you know, I'm always casting around looking for interesting stories. And in 2013, there was an obituary in The New York Times for a woman named Dolores Price, who I mentioned earlier, who was the first woman to join the IRA as a real frontline soldier. And she had lived this very colorful, kind of dramatic life that in some ways sort of stretched from the beginning of the Troubles right to the end. And in this obituary, it mentioned that in the final years of her life, she was really traumatized by some of the things she'd done when she was young. She started speaking out. She started kind of defying the code of silence that the IRA had. And one of the things that she acknowledged having been involved in was the abduction and murder of Jean McConville. And so it was, interestingly enough, I mean, for me, the whole the seed for this book was right there in that obituary, because you had the story of these two women, one a victim, one a perpetrator. And I thought that there might be a way to use those stories and the kind of intersection between the two of them to tell a bigger story about the Troubles.
And what do you hope people learn from the bigger story of the Troubles? I mean, as we head into, and I feel like I have to ask the longer question,
yeah,
I guess,
please.
Right? Yeah. So with all the trips you've made to Ireland for research on this book and the recent developments regarding Brexit, do you have a sense that opening up and examining these atrocities might allow for better dialogue in the face of the hard border returning to Ireland? Will there be a better dialogue, or will old animosities return?
It's a great question. I mean, one thing I became very convinced of is that you might want to try and bury the past, but it won't stay buried. And I think that you have this landmark peace agreement in 1998 in Northern Ireland, which appeared to end the Troubles. But part of that agreement was that there was no real discussion of what happened in the past. How do we deal with the past? There was no truth and reconciliation process, no discussion of how to address what had happened during those right. decades of violence. And I think if that was an effort to sweep it under the rug, it didn't really work. These things keep coming back. And interestingly enough, I actually think when you look at something like Brexit, part of what was happening there was that voters in the UK forgot about the Troubles. They forgot about the Irish border. They just forgot. They forgot that this was a tense issue, that this was this long-running war right there in their backyard that had gone on for decades. And they forgot that the Irish border, which today you can drive across and not even know it, used to be this fortified border, this huge flashpoint. So the crazy idea with Brexit is, if in fact the UK leaves the European Union, they're going to have to reinscribe that Irish border.
Yep.
Because that will be the border of the UK. It'll be the only land border between the EU and the UK. And I do worry that if that happens, you will see at least a return of some violence. I don't think there's an alarmist version of this story, which is that the Troubles are going to come back
right.
full force. I don't think anybody's got the appetite for that.
Because there are listeners who have said, oh, you're making, we've talked about this. On Friday nights, we try to talk about the big stories in the news. I can't do it every day because it's like drinking from a fire hydrant. So we've had listeners who are like, oh, you guys are overblowing this. It's going to be no big deal. You can go back and forth to Northern and Southern Ireland, no problem. When I was in Dublin, people were talking about how much nicer things have gotten.
Oh,
even
it's changed so much.
Over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't think it's going to be all, butterflies and unicorns.
Well, the trouble is that, look, if you have, depending on where you if you have a customs union, you need to have some way of checking what comes in and out. And if that's a border, even if it's not sandbags and guys with guns, if it's customs inspectors, the symbolism of the Irish border, it was the border crossings, that was where the IRA snipers used to lurk to try and go after the people who were manning those crossings. So I just think it's going to, it's like picking a scab, basically. Yeah. And I don't know what that will mean, but I don't think it's going to mean anything good.
We are talking to Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author of Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. And when he came in, I had just read that his book was optioned by the same producers who did the O.J. Simpson movies, the limited series and the assassination of Gianni Versace. And this is an interesting way, I think, and I hope that, that Hollywood is so crazy, but congratulations on that and the opportunity to tell this story of all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was excited. I mean, Nina Jacobson and Brad Simpson, the producers, are people I've known for a while, and I have just the highest regard for them. And they were really fascinated by this story and felt as though the history of the Troubles would be interesting to explore through the lives of these characters.
And the role of women in that movement.
Absolutely. Right. And that's that's an aspect that is women are often written out of the history of the Troubles. And so I think the part of the appeal was telling the story of some of these women who ended up being kind of critical symbols of those years. And they're very, Brad and Nina also did they did the Hunger Games and they did Crazy Rich Asians and they're doing The Goldfinch. They're book people, so even though those projects are all very different in terms of the way they look, I feel as though they're very true to the books at the heart of them. So that gives me a lot of confidence.
Well, it's a detail. I think that they, everything from what's the prosecutor's name from O.J. Simpson from talking about her hair. I mean,
Marcia Clark.
Marcia Clark. Those small moments, and sometimes those are the most important moments.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to thank you for. Well, I'm grateful that obituary appeared in 2013 that you seized upon an important story that needed to be told. And again, congratulations on all of it.
Thank you.
This is something that will continue. And please check out the book again. It's Say Nothing, A True Story of Murder and Memory in Northern Ireland. There's mystery, there's politics, there's religion, there's so much that we still don't understand. And I think this sheds such an incredible light on it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Get some rest at some point.
Yeah, I'll do it.
More after this on 720 WGN.